Trump, Vance, who said in 2022, I don't really care what happens to Ukraine one way or the other.
Yeah. I mean, what we heard from Vice President Harris in her speech, she didn't talk about foreign policy a lot, but Ukraine and Israel-Palestine were two issues she did touch on. She said that the United States would continue to support Ukraine's defense against the Russian invasion. She was very clear about that. And on Israel and Palestine, you know, she said the usual things about continuing to support Israel's right to defend itself, but she also lifted up the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and very strongly reiterated support for Palestinians' right to freedom and self-determination. Now, that language was unsatisfying for a lot of people, myself included. I wish she could have leaned into it a bit more, but I do think it's worth noting that this is the first time we've heard that kind of language from a candidate for president from the Democratic Party in their speech, their acceptance speech at the convention. So again, while I expect the Uncommitted Movement and other allies to continue pushing on this, I think it's worth just noting that. Now from Vance and Trump, yes, as you said, Trump, as you know, has been kind of a fan of Putin for a long time, doesn't seem to really care about Ukraine. Vance himself has suggested that our support for Ukraine is distracting from the real enemy, which is China. I think that's a pretty consistent approach between Trump and Vance. They see China as the new big enemy and Ukraine as more of a distraction.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. So much more has to be discussed, but we have to leave it there. Matt Duss, Executive Vice President of the Center for International Policy, speaking to us from Washington, D.C., and Vladimir Slivyak, co-chair of the Russian environmental organization EcoDefense, who won the 2021 Right Livelihood Award, speaking to us from Berlin, Germany. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently hiring a camera operator to work during our live TV broadcast. Learn more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Shrupa Bokadus, Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, community radio.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited series coming to our airwaves and your favorite podcast platform. It's called Running on Air, a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. Every weekday, your favorite KBOO host will be facilitating a deeper conversation with these candidates, so tune in. Our first episode is Tuesday, September 3rd at 10 a.m. Find the full schedule on our website, kboo.fm/runningonair. Listen to any episodes of Running on Air that you miss on the KBOO website or wherever you get your podcasts. That's kboo.fm/runningonair.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this special membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, a record-setting wildfire and drought season, and there's still more weeks to come. Oregon gets ready for some big changes when it comes to its drug laws on September 1st. And how your vote matters when it comes to your health care.
Every instinct that I have tells me there will be a major assault on the Medicaid program.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 29th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. The Pacific Northwest's aggressive wildfire season persists. As of this month, Oregon preliminarily reported 1.5 million acres burned so far in 2024, which is far above the annual average over the past 10 years and is now greater than the previous high in 2012. The largest of the 2024 wildfires have been the Durkee, Cow Valley, and Battle Mountain Complex fires. The Paddock Fire in Idaho burned more than 180,000 acres, making it the third largest wildfire in that state's history. And according to the U.S. Drought Monitor, 61% of the Pacific Northwest Drought Early Warning System region is experiencing moderate to exceptional drought. Here's an update from Oregon State climatologist Larry O'Neill.
It's been actually quite an eventful summer as far as drought conditions go. And one of the things that was really interesting about this summer is that we didn't necessarily expect us to have as dry as conditions so widespread as we ended up getting. We had a relatively wet June. It gave way to historically warm July, punctuated by the early July heat wave across much of the U.S. West, and particularly in Western or in Oregon and Western Washington. And it really led to a flash drought. And this evaporated a lot of our moisture that was in the soil and the thin air. Because of this, drought increased substantially in coverage and intensity throughout the Pacific Northwest. And it really exacerbated snow drought conditions that had developed within Washington and parts of Idaho and Montana. This led to really active fire season, particularly in eastern Oregon. We are currently at an all-time record high for a number of acres burned in Oregon, and we still have a few more weeks left in fire season. We're also struggling with low summer stream flows in parts of Washington, Montana, and northern Idaho that was brought on by the snow droughts and the very warm July and excessive evaporation. Last week brought showers and thunderstorms widespread to the region. And while it was welcome, beneficial rainfall, it was not enough to end either the drought or the very high wildfire risk that we're currently dealing with. 61% of the Pacific Northwest region is experiencing some form of drought. Widespread drought developed within Oregon, and drought conditions intensified in Washington, Idaho, and Montana, including a small spot of exceptional droughts in western Montana, and then extreme droughts in the east side of the Washington Cascades. So drought conditions definitely went the wrong way. And about 61% of Oregon and Washington experienced their warmest July on record. Just widespread hot weather throughout the region. It was really most intense within Oregon and Washington. If you look at July by itself, both Oregon and Washington experienced their second warmest July on record. And Idaho and Montana were also very much warmer than normal as well. Both Oregon and Washington, this was also the second warmest month on their records. And the only warmest month from that was July 2021. And in Oregon, the July 2021, which is when we had the heat dome event, in Oregon, out of 1,900 possible station observations of temperature during that period, daily records were broken at 696 stations there. That's close to 40% of the temperature observations broke their records. And Washington also broke about 24% of their temperature records, so 243 out of 1,016. And Montana, Idaho also had quite a few record brokens, although the heat wave was not quite as historically intense. So this heat wave really caused a flash drought, which dried out soils and vegetation way too early in the summer. And it left much of the Pacific Northwest at driest levels that we typically experience at peak dry season in late August and early September. But the timing of this heat wave was really critical for guiding how this summer's drought and wildfire conditions evolved. The heat wave caused a lot of evaporation of moisture from both the soil and the vegetation. So the heat wave basically just sucked all that moisture out of the soils. It set all-time records. And this occurred in southeast and central Oregon. And this is where our fire danger really blew up during early July. We also experienced very high levels of evaporation compared to historical conditions all throughout the Pacific Northwest, and definitely including central Washington and most of Oregon. Over the last 60 days, and then it was actually quite a bit above normal as we get to southwest Oregon, and that owed to the showers and thunderstorms that we had last week, which dropped a couple more than 3 inches of rain. When you go east of the Cascades, everywhere there else had much less precipitation than normal. That combined with the excessive evaporation really drove drought conditions to deteriorate pretty rapidly. And so one of the big impacts for this year has been the wildfires. Oregon has seen over 1.5 million acres that have burned so far this year. This is a preliminary number, but it would seem to beat out the old record in 2012 as being the most active wildfire season. It's been not quite as active in Washington, but still close to 300,000 acres have burned. And we still have about three or four more weeks of fire season to go.
That's Larry O'Neill, Oregon State climatologist. Oregon's new state law, which recriminalizes the use of drugs, starts on September 1st, and that's going to mean some big changes for law enforcement and public transportation. TriMet's Chief Safety and Security Officer is Andrew Wilson. Tell me about what's going to be different as of September 1st when it comes to the statewide implementation of HB 4002 and how it affects TriMet.
I hope that our riders are starting to see the additional security increases that we've got out there. We've got a lot more personnel, over 400 now, working in the Safety Security Division. Adding that presence and just providing for better, safer transit for our customers. HB 4002, which goes into effect on September 1st, is an exciting new tool that we're going to be working with our law enforcement partners on in really adding some criminal penalty to drug use on the stations and platforms and as well as on vehicles. I will say that Senate Bill 1553, another key tool that the Oregon state legislature provided to us to increase safety on the transit system, that bill goes into effect on January 1st, and that actually adds even a stiffer penalty, Class A misdemeanor, for drug use on vehicles. So both of these tools, we're going to be working with our law enforcement partners to really increase safer transit out of the system. But I would say that TriMet's been really focused on this over the last couple years, even before these tools were available to us. And that's been through our increasing security presence. We now have a security operations center as well that people can call into 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. 503-238-RIDE is the number for that. And we really encourage our riders to go ahead and reach out to that. They see something that makes them uncomfortable that they want to involve our security in, and we're going to dispatch resources to that. We do want people to continue to call 911 if they see a criminal act first, but they can get in touch with our security if they're just seeing a code violation, some behavior issues, or just feel uncomfortable. We want to have that tool out there.
You already had in TriMet's Code of Conduct the rules for riding state that they already prohibit drug use. So how is it really going to be changing in September?
We're excited to work with our partners in really bringing that activity to limit drug use, open drug use on in our community, but also on our system. We're really excited to bring them into that and be a part of that solution. And again, we've got a lot of eyes and ears out there, our riders, our security presence. And so we're going to be really working actively with our law enforcement partners to make this tool something that can work, I think, as the Oregon State Legislature really intended it, which is to limit drug use, open drug use, in our communities. We're going to use that at TriMet as much as we possibly can. And we've been focused on this before this law was in place. Senate Bill 1553 is an even stiffer penalty specific to transit vehicles, which goes into effect on January 1st. This is a good direction we're headed. We're optimistic at TriMet that we're going to continue to see reductions in open drug use on the system, in and around the system, and hopefully in our community.
I recall there were some stories quite a few months ago where they took the air samples on TriMet on some of the trains, and they found traces of fentanyl, traces of cocaine, and things like that. Is that part of the reason why this is going to be useful, is that people were actually using these substances on public transit?
Yeah, TriMet did participate in a University of Washington study to try to analyze how much drug residue was showing up on trains and buses. Thankfully, that study, although we voluntarily wanted the information, revealed that really outside of some small surface transmission, that there really wasn't much there, even with some of the issues that we were having a couple years ago with limiting drug use on the system. That was 2022, 2023. We have seen over the last couple of years just real incredible reductions in people using, particularly on the vehicles, but also the stations and platforms. And that has been because we've been focused on increasing our presence and increasing our partnerships. And so we did have a study that was completed. We at Sound Transit and some other peers learned some valuable data points. But the bottom line is we never want drugs on our system with this increased amount of presence and law enforcement. This is us trying to eliminate it entirely. We've been making some really good reductions just with our security presence, but we're excited for law enforcement to have additional penalties to assign to hold people accountable and make sure this doesn't happen.
So as of September 1st, this coming week, TriMet's transit police, as well as any other police officers, can cite people for drug possession that could result in up to 180 days in jail. And as far as what's kicking in January, how is that going to be even more strenuous?
Yeah, it's basically the difference in penalties. SB 1553 is a Class A misdemeanor versus a Class B for 4002. So you're going to have stiffer penalties. And obviously, you can't have somebody using drugs in that environment. And I think everybody as a society understands that cannot be tolerated in any circumstance. And so we appreciated the legislature giving us that tool, and we're going to be working with our law enforcement partners to really ensure January 1st that stiffer penalty is assigned and that people are held accountable. The last couple of years, we've also added, we have two DAs now on contract with Multnomah County District Attorney that are actually assigned to TriMet. They work hand in hand with our partnerships with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Department. Great partnership that we have with them and other law enforcement agencies to fill out our transit police division. And when you have a couple DAs, you have some sheriff's office and law enforcement, we can hold folks accountable. And so we're excited to just continue to reduce and continue to offer a real safe, reliable, and clean transit service for Portland Metro.
How common was it a problem where people were violating the rules that you already had in place and using drugs? Any idea how frequently?
Well, we do have some stats. I don't want people to think it was very common, but I think it's really shocking when you're sitting next to someone or you're sitting in a car and you see somebody openly using drugs. That is something that has spilled over from a community that's really dealing with a drug crisis out on the streets. And our ability to limit that is a very open public transit system. And that's why we've made such incredible investments in the safety and security department over the last couple of years to provide a presence to get those folks off of the trains and keep that behavior off of the trains.
And that was my talk with TriMet's Chief Safety and Security Officer, Andrew Wilson. This election cycle has already got experts talking about how people's votes in November could impact their health care in the coming years. Drew Altman is the president and chief executive officer of the Kaiser Family Foundation and a leading national expert on health policy.
My job is to talk about what actually might happen if Trump is president. Every instinct that I have and all of my experience tells me that there will be a major assault on the Medicaid program, possibly also including parts of the ACA, like diluting some of the coverage provisions and diluting, not eliminating, the protections for people with pre-existing conditions, all of which is what Trump calls making the ACA better. The Medicaid program is no pushover, not even close to that. It covers 82 million Americans, down from over 90 million Americans. It's also the single largest source of federal funding for the states. It's the primary source of coverage for long-term care, insurance coverage, and for people with disabilities. Those are very powerful lobbies at the state level. Half the babies delivered in most states are covered by the Medicaid program. It's not as popular as Social Security and Medicare, but in all of our surveys for years and years, people are almost as resistant to cutting it as cutting Medicare and Social Security. But there are several forces that I believe will conspire to make it the main target. Republicans are not going to want to cut, forget what Trump said, Social Security and Medicare, because as soon as the election's over, it's the midterms start to loom, and they're just not going to want to give the Democrats a powerful issue to hit them over the head with for the midterms. There are proposals in the right-leaning think tanks to convert Medicare to a voucher-like or premium support program. I don't think they will go there. And even if they do, but especially if they don't, the Republicans in Washington are going to desperately need savings to pay for their tax cuts. And the only other big program left is the Medicaid program. They also don't like the Medicaid program. They see it as a program that primarily serves Democratic voters. By the way, they're about my calculations, 20 million Republicans on Medicaid. They see it largely as a form of welfare assistance, just like cash assistance. They don't see it as health insurance coverage. And that's fundamental, because when you see it that way, you are more comfortable with it. If you see it instead as insurance coverage and part of a continuum of coverage in our country, you're more likely to want to protect it. You're much more likely to want to expand it. So all of these forces are going to converge. Trump has said he won't touch Social Security or Medicare, but to some of us, his silence on Medicaid is the loudest thing he's said. It's actually deafening. And among the proposals developed by Trump-affiliated groups, the Republican Study Committee, which is a very conservative group in the Congress, has proposed a series of complicated block grants that lump together all of the ACA coverage provisions and all of the Medicaid program, and their estimate would reduce federal spending on low-income coverage by $4.5 trillion over a 10-year period. So you just can't do that without decimating coverage for low-income people. 2025 has proposed three-year time limits on how long people can get Medicaid coverage. You can think of it like cash assistance. You shouldn't get, in their mind, cash assistance forever. The Paragon group, another group, has proposed incentives to end the Medicaid expansion and a disincentive to continue the Medicaid expansion if you're a state that has it. What happens in Congress will determine the scope of what they can do. A Democratic House or a Democratic Senate will block the most draconian action. The other big debate will be about abortion. I, for one, do see Trump signing a national ban with the three exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother, but painting himself in doing that strangely as the moderate. I also think abortion is illustrative of something we will see generally. The red states and the blue states will be moving in totally different directions, what you saw in COVID, but I think a much more extreme version of that.
And that's Drew Altman, the president and chief executive officer of the Kaiser Family Foundation in California. You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $30,000 by September 21st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. At 6 is Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, clear skies, a low down to 58. Tomorrow's weather, mainly sunny, hot, up to 96. Today in history, on this date in 2008, Republican presidential candidate John McCain announced he chose Sarah Palin as his running mate. The quote of the day is from Palin. They say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull? Lipstick. An Arlington National Cemetery official was shoved in an altercation with former President Donald Trump's staff during a wreath-laying ceremony intended to honor service members killed in the Afghanistan war withdrawal. An Army spokesman said the cemetery employee was trying to make sure those participating in the wreath-laying ceremony were following rules against political activities on cemetery grounds. Trump's been facing blowback since NPR reported that two campaign staff members verbally abused and pushed aside a cemetery official who tried to stop them from filming and photographing in Section 60. That's the burial site for military personnel killed while fighting in Afghanistan or Iraq. The Trump campaign claims his team was granted access to have a photographer and contests the allegation that the campaign staffer pushed a cemetery official. Trump visited the cemetery on Monday at the invitation of surviving family members to mark the third anniversary of the suicide bombing at the Kabul airport that killed 13 American service members and more than 170 Afghanis. A video Trump shared on TikTok shows several clips of his visit. As a guitarist strums in the background, there's a voiceover of the Republican nominee saying, quote, "We lost great people, what a horrible day it was. That disaster, the leaving of Afghanistan," end of quote. Trump has been trying to attach his Democratic opponent, Vice President Kamala Harris, to the Afghanistan war withdrawal, but he actually approved the plan before he left office. An anonymous defense official says the Trump campaign was warned about not taking photos in Section 60 before their arrival and before that altercation. The Trump campaign also posted a message signed by relatives of two of the service members killed in the bombing that said the former president and his team conducted themselves with respect and dignity. Michael Tyler, a spokesperson for Harris, says the reports of the altercation were, quote, "what we've come to expect from Donald Trump and his team," end of quote. The incident was reported to police, but because the employee decided not to press charges, the Army says it considers the matter closed. And Vice Presidential candidate J.D. Vance says current VP Kamala Harris can go to hell over that controversy at the Arlington Cemetery. Supreme Court Justice Jackson says she's prepared as she can be for election cases and an Idaho project aims to bridge political divides. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's 2024 Talks.
She wants to yell at Donald Trump because he showed up. She can go to hell.
Reacting to criticism over an event at Arlington National Cemetery last week, Republican Vice President nominee J.D. Vance is blasting Vice President Kamala Harris over the withdrawal from Afghanistan 3 years ago. Former President Donald Trump commemorated the withdrawal at the cemetery with families of those killed, but his aides reportedly got in a physical altercation with Arlington staff trying to stop the campaign from illegally using it as a partisan backdrop. Harris and her running mate Tim Walz started a two-day bus tour through southeast Georgia aimed at rural and black voters. Before leaving, Walz spoke about workers' issues at a firefighters union convention in Boston.
We believe that workers deserve to collectively bargain for fair wages, safe working conditions, good health care, and secure retirement.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott says the state's extreme measures are solving the immigration and border issues. But former Democratic El Paso Congressman Beto O'Rourke says the deaths of migrants solve nothing.
No one really thinks that their lives are important, but they are, and this will be a stain on our conscience and on this country unless we fix it. And the man most responsible for that right now is Greg Abbott.
Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson says she's worried about the decision granting presidents criminal immunity for official acts, implying it could be an issue if Trump is reelected.
I was concerned about a system that appeared to provide immunity for one individual under one set of circumstances.
When asked if she's ready for 2024 election cases reaching the Supreme Court, Jackson says she's as prepared as anyone can be. New polling shows Americans think this fall's election will have a major impact on the Supreme Court. Lawyer with advocacy group Courage for America, Kathy Clardy Patterson, says the nation's legal institutions are being challenged like never before.
All of the rules look like they're being skirted. There's no adherence to precedents anymore. They're taking fictitious plaintiffs. They're dealing with hypotheticals that are not before the court.
Last month, President Joe Biden laid out court reform proposals, including an enforceable code of ethics, term limits for justices, and rolling back the presidential immunity decision. But it'll be very difficult for Biden to get them passed. An Idaho project is working to bridge the nation's political divide. Nancy Pelagano with United Vision Project says their volunteers are trained to facilitate authentic conversations between people with differing views.
I don't tell people they are wrong. I don't judge. I have a conversation. I listen.
I'm Alex Gonzalez.
California tribes are asking Governor Gavin Newsom to sign a bill about co-managing lands and waters.
Assembly Bill 1284 unanimously passed both houses of the state legislature this week. Scott Sullivan is vice chairman of the Talawa Dayni Nation.
This is going to allow us to deepen our relationship at a government-to-government level. It'll give us better access to our traditional ancestral territories, to improve the environment, and to reconnect our people to the land.
Tribes hope the bill will strengthen shared decision-making around the new Yurok-Talawa Dene Indigenous Marine Stewardship Area, which covers the coastline and up to 3 miles out from the Mendocino County town of Little River up to the California-Oregon border. Fawn Murphy chairs the Pulikla Tribe of Yurok people and says the tribes want to promote biodiversity and reverse erosion and environmental degradation.
As these devastating climate impacts are coming and things are changing so rapidly, we need to bring it back to what works. California tribal people have been practicing traditional ecological knowledge since time immemorial.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
Secretary Holland finalizes the protection of Alaskan lands removed by Trump, and tribal California leaders urge President Biden to designate 3 new national monuments. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez and National Native News.
U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland has finalized a decision to maintain protections for 28 million acres of wilderness lands across Alaska, known as D1 lands. It's a move widely supported by tribal and conservation groups across the state, who say removing the protection would directly threaten indigenous ways of living and critical fish and wildlife habitat. The decision follows an extensive environmental impact analysis released in June by the Bureau of Land Management that recommended the Secretary of the Interior take no action regarding the protected lands. This leaves the lands off limits to potential mineral exploration and development. The lands were set aside following passage of the 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and have been locked up ever since. The lion's share is concentrated in the western part of the state, with millions of acres lining the Norton Sound region and extending to broader, larger portions of the Yukon and Kuskokwim River systems. The Department of the Interior said the decision comes in response to an unlawful move made in 2021 during the final days of the Trump administration, when then Interior Secretary David Bernhardt signed orders to lift the protections on the land. Holland said tribal consultation must be treated as a requirement, not an option, when the federal government is making decisions that could affect tribal communities. In addition to negatively impacting subsistence hunting and fishing activities, the BLM's analysis found that as many as 117 communities could see the loss of a federal subsistence priority on some lands if protections were lifted and the state were to gain ownership. More than half of the state's 227 federally recognized tribes expressed support for maintaining protections. According to conservation group Salmon State, 183 Alaska Native communities are within 50 miles of a D1 land area, and half of all D1 lands in question lie within the range of the Western Arctic caribou herd. Alaska Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan have strongly opposed maintaining D1 protections. The public land order finalizing the decision will be published in the Federal Register. Tribal leaders and California state lawmakers held a press conference to urge President Joe Biden to designate 3 new national monuments in the state. It was held as the State Assembly considers Senate Joint Resolutions 16 and 17, which urged President Biden to use the Antiquities Act to designate the proposed Tzatitla, Chuckwalla, and Quetzal National Monuments in Northern and Southern California. The resolutions previously passed the State Senate and the Assembly Committee on Water, Parks, and Wildlife. California Native American Assembly member James Ramos says the proposed national monuments would protect lands that have cultural resources and sacred significance to tribes.
It's not just designating a monument. To us as Indian people, it's a way of life and protecting our lives of our ancestors and who we are and for future generations.
Altarina Santianis is secretary of the Torres Martinez Desert Cuya Indians.
We want it to be where our ancestors were able to enjoy it and live in it. And we also want that for the present and for the future generations, where we can also share this with